I'm excited to talk about this topic because I have occasionally described myself as an evangelist for open source. And what I'm going to try and do in my talk is establish a context for open source and libraries as really an extension of our broader social and cultural mission. So my talk is not really a technical talk. It's really going to be sort of a thought piece about why open source makes sense for libraries, and also we'll attempt to address in a very brief fashion some of the questions and some of the framework that we might need to build in order to do this successfully. So I'm going to look at open source briefly in a couple of ways and think about and propose to you some of its strengths on the basis of its place as what I call a cultural construct. What is it intellectually? What is it conceptually? I'm going to talk about its advantages to some degree in relation to proprietary software because of its capacity to support innovation and flexibility. Briefly, I'll talk about some of the engineering principles that guide open source development broadly conceived. And if you've read sort of the text on open source, which is Eric Raymond's Cathedral in the Bazaar, I'm going to draw on some of the ideas in that book to describe the fundamental engineering model. And then I'll talk briefly at the end about what I think an alternative economic framework for library systems looks like when we shift our investments from paying for licensed software to building and supporting our infrastructure on our own. So that's kind of the quick snapshot of what I hope to do here. Now, one of my basic claims about libraries in general is that we exist to support and extend the function of the commons for the various communities we serve, specifically the intellectual commons. And what I mean by that is that arena of open access to ideas and cultural expression that we believe is fundamentally valuable for people to access to support creativity, innovation, and the continued development of thought. And there's no other entity within our cultural landscape that effectively subsidizes the intellectual commons for our communities. And some of you may be familiar with the work of a Stanford lawyer named Lawrence Lessig. He's written a number of very good books on the question of the commons, and probably the one that most directly addresses it is a book called The Future of Ideas. And if you're grappling a little bit with what the commons is, he gives some interesting examples of the kinds of resources that are open to everyone at no cost, starting with physical commons such as streets and parks, which are obviously subsidized by revenues that we all contribute to a tax base. But more particularly, in terms of what we do, ideas. So the theory of relativity is in the intellectual commons, and anyone can access and use the ideas embedded in that theory to develop further theories about how the physical universe works. And then in a more particular sense, all those writings that have passed out of copyright into the public domain so that no one technically owns them anymore. Now there's another really wonderful book that I commend to all of you that addresses the place of the commons in the networked digital age, and it's Yochai Benkler's The Wealth of Networks. And he provides a somewhat legalistic framework, but a really helpful framework for thinking about what the commons is. And he's drawing on a tradition in the legal literature and an emerging tradition also in the social science literature. He frames it this way. But he says that the commons refers to a particular institutional form for structuring rights of access, use, and control of resources. And he sets it up in opposition to property. With respect to property, law determines that one particular person has the authority to decide how a resource will be used. And I would assert to all of you that our sense of property and proprietary interest is largely how we relate to the commercial software we acquire. So there will be a connection that I would build on this. He goes on to say a few more things about the commons. I'm not going to try to give you an exhaustive picture of this, but the issue of property control is exclusive access to particular sets of rights. Resources in the commons may be used of or disposed of by anyone or a well-defined number of persons within a community under a particular set of rules. And in relation to open source software, there are different sets of rules because there are different licensing regimes. And I'm not going to go into the licensing regimes today, because that's a whole other talk. But there are rules around open source software. And in some ways, they're the exact opposite of the rules that we associate with proprietary software. So, my broader claim is that the library is a commons, or functions as a kind of commons, and that one of our fundamental services is to provide our communities with open access to intellectual and cultural resources. And in the context of what libraries do, the resources we provide are typically what are referred to as non-rivalrous resources, in the sense that they're not used up. If you have it and I have it, they create greater cultural good by all of us participating in the sharing of those things. And a metaphor I like to draw on, and the title of this talk comes from this, is the notion that we have traditionally, at least in North American libraries, defined our function in relation to our open stacks. Our community members can walk in, find stuff, get it, and use it without being overtly controlled or without having to request intervention to acquire that material. And I like to take that word open and sort of migrate from open stacks to open source and think about the intellectual nature of open source as a very significant and powerful extension of our commitment to that culture of openness. And one of the things we do in libraries is to facilitate the creation of new ideas by preserving and extending the intellectual commons. Now, the really interesting, I'm citing a lot of books because I am, after all, a librarian. There's a phenomenal book that I commend to all of you to read if you're interested in this, which is Steven Weber's 2004 title from Harvard University Press, The Success of Open Source. It's probably the single richest and most compelling exploration of the phenomenon that's yet been written. And there's a claim in there that I think stands at the heart of this positioning of the commons, which is that open source intellectual property aims at creating a social structure that expands, not restricts, the commons. So my foundational claim in this arena is that the cultural assumptions and social practices embedded in the creation, circulation, and use of open source software are both congruent and coextensive with the values and missions of libraries. And if anyone should be doing open source anywhere, it's us. So open source software as a technology, as a tool, as a means, as a method, effectively deepens and enhances both our commitment to and our self-consciousness about our cultural mission and our social function. I told you I was an evangelist, right? So I think we need to open up our sense of what we're about. And the expansion of this vision really asserts that open source software in the library space enhances the nature of the library as a center for participatory culture and collaborative enterprise. Another claim that I believe is essential is that libraries are social in their function. They put different ideas and different perspectives in adjacency in order to yield new insights and discoveries for their users, in order to foster the life of the mind and the life of the imagination. And I believe that the creation of open source software is a rich paradigm for this function. So, that said, just for the sake of a little definitional clarity, what is open source? And there are many flavors of it, but let's start with the basics. So it's software developed by an individual group with an interest in a particular application area or tool that is distributed, this is the key, in uncompiled, in other words, raw code form, with no licensing fees attached, in most cases, to a broader community that has a use for that software. Here's the critical piece, because you have access to that source code, it allows for the local development and enhancement of that software's function. It including, and in many cases actually requiring, that any modifications that you, as a contributor, make to that code, flows back to the community of users so they can adopt what you have added to the commonwealth of that code base. Now, I want to stress, and it's really interesting because we have a number of vendors here today, that open source is not non-commercial. It can technically be free, but it's not non-commercial. And probably the biggest open source success that we're all familiar with that resides in a clear commercial space is Linux. Linux is now heavily used commercial software that's still developed by a community of open source application specialists. The difference is it can be commercial, but it's not proprietary. And that's where it connects with this notion of the commons. Commercial entities do not own or control access to the intellectual constructs that make the software operate. Now, one aspect of this collective collaborative development process, and this is Eric Raymond's core argument in his foundational book, is that this kind of activity often, but not always and not necessarily, yields superior results to proprietary software development. And that's the struggle right now that's going on in the broader software environment between entities like Microsoft and applications like Linux, and as things move up, the application stack will determine whether or not open source can scale to the local personal application from the operating system level. And so we have a really interesting test case of open source migrating from that lower level into the application space in libraries. Now, what's characteristic of open source is not so much the software itself as the process by which it's built. And Weber makes a really interesting claim that he explores in some depth in his book, that the thing that's powerful about open source is the process by which the software is created. Software is an artifact of a process, but the process is what embeds the uniqueness and the power of open source. And he cites the example of, to talk about how processes become powerful engines of change, he talks about the development of just-in-time manufacturing by Toyota in the 1980s that fundamentally changed manufacturing globally in many ways. So it's the process that's more important than the product. Another aspect of this is that the weight of the whole process is invested in the value of use versus the value of ownership. The value of Microsoft's products accrues to Microsoft because they assert a license interest that they should be paid for using it. And they don't really care. One could argue they don't really care about users in light of Vista, for instance. They just care about their license and getting the money for themselves. But in the open source arena, the value is on getting the greatest possible number of users, broadly defined, either as application developers or as users, to embrace the tool you're developing so that the common intellectual investment in that software will result in its continuous improvement and enhancement. And the value of the open source commitment is that it, as Weber says, it shifts the point of focus of intellectual property rights away from the prerogatives of the author toward the prerogatives of future generations of users, not just current users. So now I'm going to jump to a slightly different topic. So that's what open source is, and I want to draw a little bit on Eric Raymond's comments about how it's built and why it's built to give you a sense of what might result in its superiority over time. He has, Raymond identifies some key principles for successful open source software development. And, you know, others have extended Raymond's initial claims, but I want to just talk about some of the principles that are valuable here. He says most good open source applications begin because some developer or some technology person has a need. They need to scratch an itch, as he puts it. So it's not just developed in the abstract. It's typically developed in response to something that needs to be done that can't be done with the available solutions. Another thing that he asserts is fundamental about the process of open source software evolution is that it's typically built on or extends applications or tools that have already been put in place by someone. It's also high, when it's effectively engineered, it's highly modular. You don't build big monolithic packages. You build pieces that do well-defined specific tasks that play well together. And that results in certain kinds of economies, and that also results in a development process that can be scaled to very rapid implementation cycles, because you're building small pieces and putting them together, using simple standards and methods to connect those components. So it's very different from a monolithic software engineering approach managed hierarchically from the top with a set of principles outlined from day one. And I actually blanch a little bit when I hear, you know, comprehensive requirement statements and all these kinds of sort of bureaucratic things layered onto what I think can be a potentially rich anarchy. I don't think open source acquisition should be characterized by RFP writing. I think that's probably, even for an entity like that, but that's an aside. Another principle is smart data, dumb code. Make your code simple and build complex data entities that support the functions of the code. Another principle, this comes from this notion of rapid iteration that can achieved through modularity, is release early and release often. Build something that you can extend through simple modifications quickly over time, get it in the field, let people use it, create a feedback loop that results in perpetual improvement. And then, you know, assuming something scales up and has a large user base, the famous quote from Cathedral Bazaar is, "To many eyes, all bugs are shallow." So if lots of people are looking, lots of highly technical people are looking at the Linux code base, that kernel is going to get pretty lean and pretty clean pretty fast, because anything that's wrong with it, someone's going to find. Okay, so open source economics. This is Richard Stallman's formulation. Some of you know Richard Stallman, the Free Software Foundation founder from MIT. He coined a wonderful phrase: open source is only free as in speech, not as in beer. And again, I think it connects to the commons thing. So it's not free in the sense that it requires technology support Perhaps the costs are distributed differently, but it requires expert personnel who are paid fairly well to do their work. It requires commitment of various kinds of resources from hardware on up. Obviously, if you're moving from a proprietary software arena to an open source arena, there's going to be migration and implementation costs. Those are unavoidable. There are ongoing support needs and costs. The issue is not that there aren't costs. The issue is how the costs are distributed and what control you have over them. There's, I think, a greater investment in development for users of open source software than there is in pure support. Hardware is usually cost neutral in most open source application areas, in relation to proprietary software. Licensing costs are typically eliminated, as are maintenance fees, not all maintenance fees, but maintenance fees figured as a portion of the purchase price. Your software costs $500,000, so you pay $50,000 a year to maintain it. That kind of price structure goes away. Now, I think there's another place that we can get to. Whenever I have conversations about open source, one of the first things people say, well, it sounds all really, really nice idealistically, but how are we really going to do it? And you know, I've been thinking about this for a while. And I think libraries are sitting on a lot of assets that they invest in commercial software. And you're all here probably because you, like many of us in this business, for probably, I would say, the last decade, have been experiencing an escalating amount of frustration with the mismatch between the software we purchase for lots of money and the arenas in which we want to function in the digital age. So the hurdle is, how do you redirect the money you're already spending for technology into a fundamentally different technology regime? And that's the challenge. It's not, can we do it, should we do it? It's how can we do it? So let's just say that all of us somehow manage to cancel one or two things, software licenses, databases, whether to take 25% of what we currently pay to proprietary software purveyors and put it into open source. That would be a beginning, and it would be a significant beginning. There's also out there, I think, new business opportunities. We have people here today talking about new business models in software support. I, as you heard, am the president of Palinet, the Palinet board, and Palinet is a consortial entity that is looking very, very vigorously into how that consortium could provide services in the open source arena. They're also brokering services of LibOne and others, so that I think there are a set of emerging business models that are going to provide us a place to put this money to make this begin to happen. There's a need for high-quality, low-cost migration and support services. That's what we need, and I think we can figure out, put the money on the table, how to make it happen. We need to deepen the culture of collaboration and technology sharing in libraries to extend our commitment to resource sharing to the level of staff and expertise, and stop worrying about what's in our little baskets that we do well that other people don't have. Because there is an implicit competition between libraries for who does it better. We need to get past that and do it together well. We need, wherever possible, to reallocate positions to technology development. We need to look at every single vacancy in our libraries to determine whether or not we should hire a programmer, a technologist, an implementer, etc. And not think about the old jobs we do. We put that money into technologists, we're going to have a cohort of people who can help us build and extend this stuff. And we need to take the risk of just cutting off some of our commercial software payments. for Stabler Staff Assistance. You know, I pay a ridiculous amount to ex-leavers for my Voyager system every year, and I get minimum back. If I stop paying them, what's the real risk to me? Especially if I know I'm going somewhere else in a year. So what we need, I think, is a collective commitment to realizing the potential of open source systems and libraries to make this more than intellectually appealing, to make it practical as a solution. We can make it economically viable, I believe, even in the near term. I think within the next 2 years, we could turn this environment upside down. It just takes some courage. I think leaders in libraries need to understand what's at stake here and think about it not only in relation to technology costs, but in relation to our mission, the platform we stand on in the culture. Because open source is critically and essentially related to what we do. And I believe we can do it, and I think we should do it. I just want to summarize here for you a couple of the books I cited that I think are worth looking at. Again, Yochai Benko's Wealth of Networks, Lawrence Lessig's The Future of Ideas, Eric Raymond's Cathedral Bazaar, and then Stephen Weber's Success of Open Source. So that is basically the end of my sermon, my pitch. I hope that through the rest of the day, there's a little more nuts and bolts stuff. I just kind of wanted to set the context for you about why I think this is urgent and why I believe we can do it. I look forward to hearing the rest of the speakers, and I think we're holding questions to the end, right? Okay, thanks a lot.